Good evening and welcome behind the news for November 7, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks, at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. And happy 85th birthday to the Russian Revolution, for those of you who are keeping track of such things. We've got two segments scheduled tonight. First, we'll speak with the author Christopher Hitchens about his book, Why Orwell Matters, and associated issues that may arise during the course of the conversation. And then at the bottom of the hour, or slightly after, we'll speak with Anatole Levin, who is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, about the coming war with Iraq. And since time is pretty short, I should bring on Christopher Hitchens. Not enough time to comment on yesterday's elections, except to quote the observations of the Reverend Al Sharpton, who said of the Democrats, when you ask for nothing, you get nothing, which seems like a pretty succinct analysis of what happened on Tuesday. So let's move on and speak with Christopher Hitchens, who is the author of the book Why Orwell Matters, just published by Basic Books. Christopher is also the author of many other books, including The Trial of Henry Kissinger, Letters to a Young Contrarian, Unacknowledged Legislation, and No One Left to Lie To, and, of course, the missionary position on Mother Teresa, formerly a columnist for The Nation magazine and now a columnist for Vanity Fair, and has been for years. Welcome to WBAI, Christopher Hitchens.
Nice to be back.
Thanks for joining us. So let's start. Why a book on Orwell right now?
Well, the cheap answer would be, and often the cheapest answer is the correct one, that next year, 2003, is his centennial. And I didn't want that to pass, either as a literary event or indeed as a publishing one. I thought someone should say, he only made it to be 46. He's almost a figure of the 19th century in our memories. He was, you know, some of his memories were Edwardian, nearly Victorian, but he managed to come out of the 20th century ahead of the game by having convincingly shown that imperialism, fascism, and Stalinism were deadly anti-human systems. And those were the three great questions of the 20th century, and he's the only public intellectual who got all of them right. I don't mean right just simply by being correct. I think he got them right for the right reasons. And the other way in which I wanted to commemorate him and acknowledge him was his argument about the relationship between language and truth and logic, and the way that he found a new idiom for arguing about these things and cautioned people about the death traps that lie within their language. And if I may, I think it was wrong of you to... I don't know what Anatole is going to say, but he knows the war coming is not with Iraq. It's an intervention against Saddam Hussein, at least for those of us who favor it. So one must beware of using euphemisms in one's own language as well as notice euphemisms in others, like, say, collateral damage. Anyone can spot that, but the people who say a war with Iraq rather than with Saddam Hussein are confusing Iraq with Saddam, which is just what he wants you to do.
Well, actually, I recorded the interview with Anatole earlier in the day, and he said, be sure to say hello to you.
I'm glad to hear it. You know, it was an admonition to you, my dear. I mean, well, that was how you...
well, yes, I think it is.
Just, in other words, not a mere... Just always look to one's own language as well as be aware of the propaganda that's in other people's.
Well, unfortunately, I was hoping to hold off on this for a few minutes until we exhausted the immediate subjects of the book, but...
By all means, let's stay on my book. I'm just kidding.
Any war against Saddam Hussein is going to involve lots of Iraqis who may or may not like Saddam Hussein, so it's kind of a very difficult distinction to make, to separate Saddam from the people who surround him,
well,
who are likely to be bombed.
The existence of the regime is the proximate cause, really is the proximate cause of the war, and since the regime is obviously not going to last very much longer anyway, that's whether you count simply dates and life expectancy or observe the obvious deliquescence of the dictator himself. Or, I mean, the consequences, in other words, of a post-Saddam Iraq are going to be with us whether there's an intervention or not. I'm personally a historical materialist. I think you are too. I hope some of your listeners will say the same. There's no way of not having the implosion of Ba'athist, Saddamist Iraq. The only question is, should the United States or its friends or allies or any others be involved in this, or should they just watch it and wonder what's going to happen? But the option of not having it, this trauma of civil war, possibly, religious war, conceivably, tribal war, arguably, intervention from other outside powers, certainly, in the case of perhaps Turkey, the option of not having that doesn't exist. So it seems to me that makes it very much clearer, if one thinks about that, than is suggested by the peaceniks, who suggest that these consequences only result from an intervention.
Let's hold off just another 3 or 4 minutes and exhaust the topic of your book first. Political taxonomists have had a difficult time with Orwell. People on the left have embraced him and rejected him. People on the right have tried to claim him as one of their own. Is this enterprise at all valuable, and where do you come in on the subject?
Well, I've sort of changed my mind about this since I wrote the book. I mean, I'm convinced that the neoconservatives who claim him are wrong, for example, that they say he was so anti-communist that he would have supported them in Vietnam, even though he was also very anti-colonialist. In my book, I say he was so root and branch anti-colonialist that he would have seen the origins of the Vietnam War and would have rejected them with contempt. He wouldn't have joined the neocons. But let's suppose I'm wrong. Suppose he had. I'd far rather argue with him and with his mind and with his way of thinking than I would with Norman Podhoretz, with whom there's nothing to argue about. So squabbling over the corpse isn't that important. In his lifetime, he withstood every temptation to leave the ranks of the socialist left and distinguished himself within those ranks as a great egalitarian, as a great investigator of poverty and its causes, as a great denouncer of imperialism, as a great volunteer fighter against fascism. And we know that he had the chance to move to the right because it was always being offered to him. He never took it, but maybe he would have done. Nonetheless, I'd rather have argued with him than with the people who claim him, and I'd certainly rather argue with him than with the people who said that by criticizing Stalin, he let down the left, because if they want to identify Stalin with the left, that's their problem, isn't it? Not mine.
Nor mine. Let's now bring this up to date, because there's certainly a lot of Orwellian aspects of the present that I think bear some investigation. Don't really talk much in the book about one of the things that people think of when they hear the word Orwellian, which is that heavens, East Asia is not our enemy. East Asia is our friend. The shifting alliances in the state of perpetual war and the lies at Circum. I mean, we were back in the day when Saddam Hussein was doing the work of the United States in hanging communists. We remember the days when the Mujahideen in Afghanistan were doing our work in fighting the Soviet Union. And now these people are our enemies. Does this course of events disturb you at all?
Well, it both disturbs and amuses me, because, like you, I remember it. I remember it actually in very much the same terms that you do. In fact, in the book, if I can say a word for it, I cite at length Orwell's attack on James Burnham, who was the great founder of, you know, the idea of the American Imperium, and the great left defector who became, you know, the supporter of American Empire. And Orwell wrote two very long and detailed and, I think, very clever exposés of him, showing that what his real problem was the worship of power. In the case that you just mentioned, obviously the Hitler-Stalin pact, which Orwell wrote about and I also mentioned, is the greatest change of allegiance, you know, there's ever been, and from both sides. And only a very few people were ready for it and said, don't let's just satirize this, let's oppose it. It's not just let's score points about, you know, who switched sides, but let's say, well, if there's a Hitler-Stalin pact, then you really do have all your enemies in one place. By the way, I'll add one thing. The term Cold War is coined by Orwell. He's the first person to use the term, and it's in an essay, which again I cite, which says there are two dangers about the current situation of the nuclear post-war. One is the danger of nuclear extermination, which is obvious, but not many people actually were worried about it at the time. And secondly, so the danger is of permanent superpowers with nuclear weapons who can keep redefining their enemies and keep redefining the quarrel, but who in fact have more in common with each other than they do with anyone else, and whose rule would become absolute because they were nuclear elite and impervious to democratic process. So I think these thoughts must be alive all the time in everyone's mind.
Well, now we have only one superpower that is presuming to dictate to the rest of the world what to do.
Well, only one that can do it globally, but given the size, say, of North Korea, and the relative weight of North Korea in the world economy, which is in fact nil, it means its own people are starving to death, but it's willing to put all its money into uranium rods. North Korea can certainly destroy the capital of South Korea on day one of any conflict, which would be a big consideration for those of us who cared about things like that, not for those who didn't. That being the element of blackmail. And probably can threaten Japan. That's quite a lot with a small nuclear capacity. And it does show a point that Orwell kept on making. If you have a totally regimented, totalitarian, dictatorial state which treats its own property as slaves, it's unlikely to keep it to that. It probably has ambitions beyond its own borders. And with both Mr. Saddam and Mr. Kim Jong-il, I've been to both of their countries, it's quite remarkable to see how they appear to have modeled their state on Orwell. And thus, I think the relevance of his writing on this is very fresh and very immediate.
Well, one of the reasons I evoke this history of shifting alliances is not just merely to mock the hypocrisy of it, but also to suggest that there's what we call in economics a principal agent problem. Those of us who would like to see the people of Iraq and North Korea liberated are going to rely on the United States to do that. And the United States is a country that has, in many cases, contracted with all kinds of unsavory characters to repress their populations. The United States probably doesn't really have a serious interest in a democratic Iraq. It would be a very inconvenient thing. It might devote its oil revenues towards domestic development rather than investing it in London and New York. So it seems the use of the word democracy and democratization to refer to Iraq and some of its neighbors, first of all, it seems implausible. And second of all, the United States doesn't seem like the most credible agent of such democratization.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you say there, but the same objection could have been made, indeed was made, in 1941. I mean, the United States had invested very heavily in, especially through its corporate super leaders and some of its politicians in Nazi Germany, and had decided to be neutral as long as it could be in the war against fascism. But it was impelled, nonetheless, to take the other side, whether it wanted to or not. In other words, one doesn't make a moral judgment in saying this. It isn't because the United States is a morally superior country that it takes a stand in favor suddenly of democratizing Germany. But in fact, it did end up democratizing Germany, or helping to do so. So it's a matter of objective, not subjective conditions, as I know, Douglas. I don't have to remind you. And the second thing is this. In the recent past, it seems to me, at least one faction in Washington, D.C., has decided something rather intriguing. There were root causes for September the 11th. The very thing that they wanted to avoid, the very conclusion they wanted to avoid, there are root causes. The root cause lies in the political slum the United States has been managing in the region. The client state system, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, people who will take the bribes from the empire and act as subordinates and proxies, but who secretly hate the person who's bribing and owning them, feel humiliated by it, and who turn into enemies in a surreptitious way. Therefore, the conclusion from this is, first, probably not to rely on the client state. But if you're not going to do that, and if you're not going to become the permanent occupier yourself, which is the other terrifying option, well, why not take a bet that the Iraqi people on their own or the Kurdish people on their own could come up with not just a more justifiable, but a more a stable solution? Now, those who don't believe the Iraqi or Kurdish people can do that are, I think, in a false position. I mean, those who think they shouldn't have a chance to do so. The regime change policy bets that that may not be the worst thing. So it seems to me it should be the job of the left to take up this pledge and insist that it's kept, rather than to say, what are you doing being interested in Iraq in the first place?
I'm speaking with Christopher Hitchens, author of the book Why Orwell Matters, and many others as well. The book just published by Basic Books. It seems to me that insofar as we know of any plans that the Bush administration has for a post-war Iraq, they involve making General Tommy Franks the king. They don't really seem to want... There is no democratic opposition to speak of, aside from a handful of people in exile who don't seem to like each other very much. If we look at what's going on in Afghanistan as a model, I read from a Human Rights Watch report that came out just the other day, one of our boys on the scene, one of the warlords, Ismail Khan, has been beating people with thorny branches, sticks, cables, and rifle butts. The most serious cases of torture involved hanging detainees upside down, whipping, and using electric shocks. Members of the Pashtun minority have been especially targeted for abuse. There's been almost no funding for any kind of serious rebuilding of Afghanistan. So if the model of a post-war reconstruction is Afghanistan, I don't think that this is a very inspiring one.
Well, I would remind you of an old maxim, Douglas. Don't make the best the enemy of the good. I think there probably will always be rather cruel corporal punishment in Afghanistan. No, I won't say always, but I mean, I think the likelihood is it'll go on for some time. Just as I think it'll be very hard to take the veil off in outlying regions. But a beginning has been made on that, and it's just not serious to compare this to the pre-existing situation of an absolute theocracy, which not only forbade music and destroyed all non-Islamic monuments and culture, but kept women as chattel, and incubated, which gave us serious reason to be even more interested, incubated a network of, terrorist is too weak a word for it, I mean, potentially genocidal, part multinational corporation, bent national corporation, part secret police shadow group, part cult, and part fascist organization, Al-Qaeda. There is no calculus about Afghanistan that would not come out, even with the worst that you say, saying it's enormously better off than it was a year and a half ago. And I don't think you think that that's not so. There is a contingency plan in the case of Iraq. There are many contingency plans. If things go badly, Mr. Franks might find himself spending more time there than he or anyone else wants him to, including the Iraqi people. The Iraqi opposition is not the contemptible force you describe. It has a potential majority in the country among Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish. And we can actually prove that by the following. The provinces that are not under the control of Saddam Hussein, that are under Western protection, have pluralism, elections, civil society, newspapers, television, access to the outside, and their children do not die of shortages because, though the sanctions apply, they're not administered by a totalitarian, greedy, exorbitant regime. So the humble proposal one makes is, if this can be done and proved to have been done in the north of Iraq, is there not a chance that it can be extended across the country? That's at least the test, I think, not the Tommy Franks contingency plan.
Well, as I said earlier, though, that the United States would not be terribly pleased with the likely results of any kind of democratic Iraq. It would manage its oil wealth for its own benefit rather than those of the Western financial markets. How serious do you think these people are about democratizing
Iraq?
Well,
there would be one very... if we leave aside the democratic question, because... obviously, if the United States suddenly was in favor of democratic Iraq, it would certainly be taking baby steps. I'm with you on that. It would be the first time they thought of Iraq in that way. But they have publicly placed a bet on the Iraqi and Kurdish opposition, and it should be the job of the left to say, well, you better live up to this pledge, rather than to say it's none of your business, and we prefer neutrality with Saddam Hussein, which is the current totally indefensible and unrealistic position. So who knows? I mean, there's a surplus of oil in the world. The Iraqi oil industry is using incredibly outdated and degraded technology. Wouldn't take very large investment to bring it up to speed. An enormous increase in productivity is possible, and I would remind you, while that's being done, the Saudi monopoly on this matter is broken. And who wouldn't welcome that as a happy outcome, and would that perhaps be why the Saudis, like the Turkish elite, are against regime change in Iraq? The cause of anti-regime change in Iraq, I must point out to you, I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C., has always been the cause of the conservatives in Washington. The only voices that are listened to here against regime change are those from the right, except for some people who may have imagined that Tom Daschle was really serious about such a thing, which he never was, or, I suppose, Ramsey Clark. Screen out the irrelevant voices. Critics of regime change are the Saudis, the Turks, and their clients in Washington, who are very, very numerous. And so the force in the administration that is in favor of it is still actually a minority, but it seems to be gaining ground, and in my opinion, that's an improvement over the client-state approach to Mesopotamia.
Well, you say that the right, or a certain kind of rightist, I think a corporate sort of moderate right wing, as opposed to regime change. But you have people
and the
like
Buchananite one.
Right, but Buchanan just wants to retreat from empire completely. But you have people like Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and Cheney and Pearl, who are very enthusiastic about this. Now, you've been very critical of the peace movement for being so closely associated with the Stalinoid hacks of the Workers' World Party and cranks like Ramsey Clark. But doesn't it make you at least a bit of uncomfortable to align yourself with Rumsfeld and Pearl and Wolfowitz?
Well, bedfellowism, you know, has been a problem for a lot of us for a long time and is a problem for anyone who takes any position. I mean, I would not criticize someone who was skeptical of an intervention against Saddam Hussein by saying, well, that puts you with Pat Buchanan. I would scorn myself if I used that sort of argument, and I don't, and I don't need to. By the way, it doesn't seem to embarrass them that they are in bed with various people, even more fascistic than Buchanan, and the fact that some neoconservatives agree with me, as they did over Bosnia, for example, doesn't trouble me in the least. The fact is, if there hadn't been an intervention in Bosnia and Kosovo, the Muslim population of Europe would have been put to the sword in plain sight by a Christian fascist movement, and it would be a howling wilderness now. And I'm very proud of what little I did to alert people to that possibility and to try and arrest it. Now I get attacked by people who say I'm insensitive to Islam. Well, excuse me. The Islam these people mean is Taliban and Saudi Islam. Quite frankly insufferable. And I notice, and I'm keeping score too, about the bedfellows who were together on that point, who liked Milosevic first and second the Taliban. And then when they had any spare time, as Ramsey Clark did, went to volunteer to defend the Hutu power genocide militia in Rwanda. No one ought to bring up bedfellow with me. I'm not accusing you about this, unless they're willing to have the argument right through to the end.
Well, yeah, but no, most people...
Wolfowitz, compared to that, is an extraordinary step up, because it's away from Kissingerism. It's away from Nixonism. It's away from the client-state racketeering. And it says regime change must involve a bet on local democratic and popular forces. It has to take that risk.
Well, these are also, I mean, bedfellowism in this case means that these are the people who control the weapons. It's not merely an ideological alliance. These are the people who control the weapons and the policy making that after the war is over.
Certainly. Well, if it wasn't, I'm afraid, for the control of weapons, something in this argument would be academic. I mean, we could be having this argument in Belgium and saying, should Belgium intervene against Saddam Hussein? But it would be a faint argument, wouldn't it?
Well, these forces are also...
The truth is the United States is the only enforcer of what the UN decides or doesn't decide. And it's that that makes both the US and the UN hypocritical.
Well, of course, as Rumsfeld himself said, it's the mission that dictates the coalition and not the coalition the mission. So this involvement of the UN is at best a public relations gesture from the Bush point of view.
And from the UN point of view.
But you're also aligning yourselves with some of the most enthusiastic Zionists in American politics. I know you've long been a critic of Israeli policy. Does that alliance disturb you at all?
Well, the United States has been in a... I'm sorry, Doug, I'm losing my voice a little bit here. I've been babbling all day. I hope you can still hear me.
Yes.
I may have to clear my throat once more. It's not likely that the U.S. position will be more hypocritical vis-a-vis Palestine than it was with Clinton at Camp David, or than it would have been with Gore and Lieberman And obviously the central hypocrisy remains. The U.S. pretends to be a mediator in a dispute to which it's, in fact, a party. It's the... it's the patron of the Israeli side, not the mediator. The argument now, as it runs at least, is this. If Saddam Hussein is taken off the chessboard, or falls off it, the rejectionist option no longer exists for the Palestinians, who would have that much more incentive to assign wholeheartedly a territorial agreement. And again, in that event, that being the case, there would be no reason not to press the Israelis to dismantle the settlements. Now, that might sound utopian to you, but it's much less utopian than the Oslo,
well, Rumsfeld said the,
which has been totally discredited.
Rumsfeld said the settlements were the justified spoils of war recently, didn't he?
He may well have done so. I'm certain I heard him call Sharon a man of peace, but that's nothing to Clinton running against Bush in 92 and saying, why is Bush undermining Shamir on the loan guarantees? I'm for the loan guarantees to Shamir unconditionally. People forget Clinton ran against Bush from the right on Israel, and of course, as you will remember, on Cuba, what was then called the Torricelli Bill, later became the Helms-Burton Bill. There is no way of saying that the United States policy isn't hopelessly biased in the Israel-Palestine dispute. That's, you know, a matter of judgment about the fatuous statements and opportunist commitments that are made. But Christ, do pardon me here. Let us take a swallow of water. But that doesn't mean that the current position that a post-Saddam Middle East would be an easier place in which to arrange a peace deal is any more hypocritical than any of the previous ones. My own great fear is that the annexation of the West Bank has in fact already taken place, that it has already become part of Greater Israel, and that the whole thing may be irreversible by anybody. But I do not believe that the Wolfowitz position on this is any worse than the Dennis Ross position, which used Arafat as the policeman for the occupation, and which sent Albert Gore to the West Bank to deliver a personal check, which shocked all my Palestinian friends to their core, to Arafat to set up what were called midnight courts all across his little domain, where people could be pulled out of bed at any hour of the night and tried without a judge or a jury, where the PLO bureaucracy was used as the enforcer of the occupation. It couldn't be any worse than that. All the other alternatives, taking all parties at their face value, have been tried. Regime change implies that we no longer take these people at their face value. And you may have noticed, Douglas, that once the Bush administration said to the Palestinians, we're not receiving your chairman anymore, we don't think you picked him, come back to us when you have a delegate or representative of your own choosing, that the first action of the Palestinian parliament was to vote Arafat's cabinet out. Regime change began among the Palestinians. If it were not for Sharon's moronic sadism, because he likes to have Arafat where he's got him and needs it, that regime change would have been completed by now.
We've only got a minute or so left, so I'll again let your
voice...
I am voice...
sorry to have lost my voice back there. It seems to be recuperating.
Okay. Just one more question, though. You told my friend Jeet here of the Canadian National Post that you were thinking about a non-imperial occupation of Iraq. Wondering what that means, and do you think Orwell would have approved of such a phrase?
Well, we are back in a world territory, all right, because you do need, just as one needs a word for anti-Americanism. I mean, I feel there is such a thing as anti-Americanism, but anti-Americanism is an inadequate word for it. It's a word that's been discredited by repetition and overuse and propaganda and so on. There should be a word, though, for those who dislike everything America does on principle in advance. I'll come up with one, I hope, one day. In the same way, there are people in Washington now who openly say, why don't we just say we're imperialists? Let's say it's the American Empire. Let's just move into other countries and let's just do it. Whereas there are those who say, you know, we might have to inherit responsibility of certain countries with reluctance, but because there's no alternative. Well, now, there ought to be a discourse where there are terms that separate those two ambitions and those two impulses. And I must say, I'm glad to know that that highly intelligent guy is a friend of yours, and I think all three of us should be trying to think of ways of doing so. Humanitarian interventionism, as defined by Blair, is a bit sickly and a bit hypocritical, and it can be referred to sarcastically. But we do all know from experience, from Haiti to Bosnia to Rwanda, which was a case of non-intervention, right? Rwandans suffered because there wasn't an empire to help them. Sierra Leone and so forth. You know the rest of the examples. We do know of the vast territory that exists between isolationism and imperialism. And we are going to be very interested in how to do it and how to talk about it. And yes, I wish there was an Orwell to help us define those terms.
All right, we'll have to bring it to an end there. It sounds like the cigarettes are catching up with you.
No, it's not that. It's the lack of them.
Okay, we'll go have a smoke then. Thanks for joining us, Christopher Hitchens, author of Why Orwell Matters, just out from Basic Books. And we'll be back after this word from Chicks on Speed.
Hi, my name is Julie. I like Mac power books and electronic music.
Wanna be the ruler of the galaxy.
Wanna be the king of the universe.
Let's meet and have a baby.
Chicks on Speed with their song Song for a Future Generation. I want to be the king of the universe. And now, sort of as a commentary or antidote or reflection on, I should say this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. And now, as a sequel to Christopher Hitchens, let's hear this interview recorded earlier today with Anatole Levin, who is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace based in Washington, and he certainly knows that part of the world very well. I picked him because he's not a raving radical who goes on about imperialism. He's a very respectable liberal scholar, and that's what you'll hear in this conversation. Anatole Levin.
Welcome to WBAI. What's your evaluation of what the Bush administration is after in Iraq? Is it really about the stated reasons, weapons of mass destruction and oppression of the local population, or are there really other things at stake?
It's certainly not about oppression of the local population, something which U.S. administrations have been able to live with very easily in the past in the case of Iraq. It is, to some extent, about weapons of mass destruction, but not really as that's been presented, I think. Certainly the U.S. intelligence people I know do not privately believe that there's any chance of Saddam giving such weapons to terrorists, though it is conceivably possible, of course, that he might try to use them indirectly against Israel. But I think the more important thing is that if Saddam possesses such weapons, it will give Saddam more freedom of action in the Middle East. And correspondingly, it will give the U.S. less freedom of action. It will certainly, it would force the U.S., for example, to keep large numbers of troops permanently in the Gulf. It would raise the stakes of any future American intervention in the region. But I think beyond that, the idea is really that if you can knock down Saddam Hussein, for one thing, of course, you wipe out the embarrassment of having failed to get rid of him in 1991, and the fact that this very prominent enemy of the United States is still sitting there making faces at Washington. But also, of course, you send a very impressive and frightening message to people in the rest of the world not to mess with the United States. And it's certainly believed that by doing this, you can frighten other Arab states into full cooperation in the war against terrorism, because at the moment, of course, several Arab states are certainly not cooperating fully in that conflict. So I think all these factors are there, and as, of course, is an interest in Iraqi oil.
Well, let's return to some of these questions in a bit, but back in 91, there were some reports that the U.S. let Saddam Hussein stay in power because we didn't really know what to do with a post-Saddam Iraq. We figured that the stability would be better served by leaving him there than taking him out. Was that true then, and why is that no longer true now?
I think in 1991, there were mixed feelings. You know, if the Iraqis themselves had succeeded in overthrowing Saddam, which is, after all, what everybody expected, you know, Washington would have been quite happy with that. It was more that the U.S. was very afraid of the consequences if it went in and threw out Saddam Hussein, both because that would break up the coalition in the Middle East, but also because then the U.S. would have to take direct responsibility for setting up a new Iraq after Saddam Hussein. And, of course, you're quite right. Nobody knew what that new Iraq should be. So you could say, in a certain sense, yes, that they were, well, they put it this way, they were not so unhappy with Saddam staying that they were prepared to go and get rid of him themselves. I mean, what has happened since then, obviously, is that Saddam has gone on and on defying the United States, that 9/11 has, you know, reinforced the perceived threat, at least as far as the U.S. public is concerned, from weapons of mass destruction. And, of course, you have this public momentum in the U.S., which you never had before, for a possible war with Saddam Hussein. But unfortunately, when it comes to the complete confusion about what a post-Saddam Iraq would look like, nothing has changed. The picture is just as confused, just as frightening as it always was. And of course, several of the possibilities would be, you know, not at all welcome to the United States. One of them is a separation of the Kurdish North, which would infuriate the Turks to the extent of perhaps bringing about a Turkish occupation of northern Iraq. Then there's the possibility of the creation of a Shiite state in the south, basically under Iranian auspices. And, of course, there's the possibility of civil war between all these different groups, because I don't believe that the Sunni minority, which has ruled Iraq since Iraq was created, is simply going to, you know, lie back and allow this state to be taken away from them. So it's a very worrying picture.
What about the domestic political structure of Iraq? I mean, has this been a pretty much of a one-party state in which the party pervades everything, and taking that away, there's not much left in terms of Iraqi civil society?
Yes, I think that is entirely true. It's a state founded on one party, and even before that party came to power, the Ba'ath, it was always a state founded above all on the army, and an army recruited once again overwhelmingly from a minority Sunni Arab population. So yes, I mean, the fear is that if you take that away, you're left with, well, partly of course you're left with religious forces, especially Shia ones, and you're left with Kurdish ethnic ones, and of course you're left with, you know, whatever anti-Saddam military figures you can scrape together. But I mean, it looks to me as if it would resemble in many ways the very fragile, chaotic so-called government that we've put together in Afghanistan, which has avoided large-scale civil war in Afghanistan, but it's not capable of really governing or developing the country.
Does the U.S. really care about what happens to Afghanistan going forward?
If the U.S. doesn't care what happens to Afghanistan, it certainly ought to, because in some ways, what we could be seeing is a replay of what happened in the early 90s. The U.S. was only interested in Afghanistan in order to get rid of the Soviets, in order to damage the Soviets and throw them out. Once they were out, U.S. administrations lost all interest in Afghanistan, despite the fact that they had contributed so much to the creation of chaos in that country. Well, what came out of that? 9/11 came out of that. You know, out of the chaos, out of the civil wars in Afghanistan in the 1990s came the Taliban, and came Afghanistan as a safe haven for terrorism. You know, if Afghanistan now relapses into ethnic and ethno-religious civil war, then parts of Afghanistan will once again become safe havens for terrorism. And not just that, but it will have a dramatically destabilizing effect on Pakistan. You know, and if Pakistan really becomes a safe haven for terrorism, then, you know, in my view, the war against terrorism is almost lost. So, I mean, the U.S. certainly ought to care about the future of Afghanistan.
Of course, it certainly will care about the future of Iraq because of, there's so much oil there. So,
yeah.
How big is the role of oil in formulation of policy? I mean, the administration obviously doesn't like to talk about it. Although you read some indiscreet comments in the press now and then about a lust after cheap oil. Just how big a deal is the oil aspect of the policy making towards Iraq?
I think oil is very important, but it's not the single key, if you see what I mean. One can't explain this whole strategy simply in terms of an interest in cheap or guaranteed oil. Part of the answer, I think, is that the desire for guaranteed access to Iraqi oil, for control over Iraqi oil, if you will, also fits into the wider war against terrorism. Because the feeling is that if the U.S. can escape its dependency on Saudi oil, then, of course, once again, it will be in a position to put much stronger pressure on Saudi Arabia when it comes to cooperating against Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups, that then you can really say to the Saudis, you have to crack down on recruitment and funding for these groups, or else, because now we've got a choice. You know, you can't threaten to cut off your supplies of oil to us or raise the price, because, you know, we have another source in the region. So I think it is pretty important, but it shouldn't be seen, you know, just in terms of, you know, a corrupt desire of American oil companies, you know, to maximize their profits. I think there is a very important strategic stake there as well.
All five permanent members of the Security Council have oil interests of one sort or another in Iraq. How important is that to developing a coalition, or at least approval from the veto-bearing members?
The Russians are certainly very anxious to get a piece of the Iraqi pie, partly because, as you know, they have a massive debt owed them by Iraq, which they've been, you know, pressing for guarantees that this will be repaid by a post-Saddam Iraq. But privately, they know and admit that there are very, very few chances that the debt ever will be repaid. So what they would like as compensation is a major stake, you know, for their oil companies. Though I must say I don't think that they have very much confidence on that score either in American guarantees, because, you know, the Russians feel that they, you know, they've been promised things again and again by America which they've never received. As far as the Chinese are concerned, I don't think that plays a very important role. And as far as the British and French are concerned, it's a factor, but not, I think, a dominant one. On the whole, you know, the concerns of people are much more about security, about international precedence, you know, for unilateral intervention, about the risks of this turning into a wider Middle Eastern conflict, you know, and destroying relations with the Muslim world. All these kind of things, all these kind of questions, I think, are more important for the other members of the Security Council than oil.
I'm speaking with Anatole Levin, who is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington.
Let's talk about a couple of those risks. What's your evaluation of, first of all, the likelihood of a military success in the short term, but then the possible political consequences of a U.S. War on Iraq? Is it likely to throw the rest of the region into turmoil, or is that another one of these frequent worries that just might not materialize?
The big question is whether Saddam Hussein can draw Israel in, and if so, what Israel does. Because if the war can be kept restricted to Iraq, then there's no doubt at all that America and Britain will win it. If Israel can be brought in, you know, if Saddam can actually land missiles with weapons of mass destruction in Israel and force an Israeli retaliation, then, of course, that risks drawing in other Arab states. It risks really infuriating Arab populations, perhaps leading to revolutions elsewhere in the Arab world. So, you know, that's why this whole operation is such a gamble, I think, because I believe myself that the odds of this happening are probably relatively low, given the tremendous technological and military superiority of the Allies. But, I mean, any risk of this kind is sufficiently, you know, frightening to have to be taken very seriously.
And what about the plans for a post-war Iraq? We've read that they've been contemplating making Tommy Franks the king of Iraq. Is there anything beyond that, or do they have an idea what they're going to do?
I don't think they have the slightest idea what they're going to do. Frankly, a lot of the talk of this creating a, you know, a tsunami of democracy in the Middle East is, and of, you know, creating a modern, democratic, successful country in Iraq is just talk by people, frankly, who know absolutely nothing about the country, the region, and it's really quite shocking in a way, you know, that serious people can talk such rubbish and unfortunately be believed, you know, unless the place is simply going to be allowed to relapse into chaos. There will have to be a U.S. military government, as there was in Germany and Japan after 1945. The question is, of course, how long such a military government can stay in place. I mean, how long America is prepared to deploy tens of thousands of troops to garrison that country. And also, of course, what kind of long-term threats such a garrison would come under. So I think, yes, that military government is probably the way that it will have to go.
That's not going to be taken too kindly by a regime in a country that's not comfortable with the idea of soldiers taking casualties.
Well, you know, if the American public doesn't want soldiers to take casualties, it should pay closer attention to, you know, the kind of aims set out in Bush's new strategic doctrine. You can't run this kind of imperial policy in the long run by means of, you know, long-range smart bombs. You want to exert this kind of hegemony, you've got to have soldiers on the ground, and some of those soldiers will die. Possibly very large numbers of them will die over time. But, you know, if you don't want to risk that, then, you know, observe a more restrained policy. Because, you know, this business of trying to run Afghanistan through a shambolic, you know, junta of different chieftains, while the U.S., while small numbers of U.S. troops run around simply hunting terrorists, is, in my view, doomed, in not just in the long term, but in the medium term. And a repetition of that, you know, in Iraq will not merely be doomed, but it risks plunging the entire Middle East into the deepest instability. I think there should be much more discussion in the United States of whether America really wants an empire, whether it needs an empire, whether this is the right way to go about creating one. You know, all these questions have not been addressed here. And, you know, instead, what we've had to listen to is fatuous talk, as I say, about some tidal waves of democracy in the Middle East by, you know, talkers, public intellectuals who, frankly, you know, could not be trusted to run a kebab stall in an Arab country, let alone advise on the future administration of a major Arab state. If you're going to have a successful empire, looking at the empires of the past, you don't just need, you know, to have large numbers of soldiers who are willing to die. You also need to have cadres of experts on particular regions, you know, who really understand them, who speak the languages, and are really committed to these areas for their entire careers. America lacks that at present.
You've used the word empire and imperial. It used to be that only Marxist intellectuals used these words, and now we're seeing in the daily newspapers. What precisely are the Bush administration's ambitions?
If you read the strategic doctrine, the new strategic doctrine, and if you read the papers, you know, which underlie that, from, you know, dating back to 1992 and the famous paper by Paul Wolfowitz, the intention is quite clearly global hegemony underpinned by overwhelming military force. You know, it's obviously not a territorial empire like the old British Empire or, you know, the Russian Empire. It doesn't involve America, you know, conquering and annexing places. But it does involve America running a whole set of client states, client regimes, possibly against the wishes of, you know, many of their own subjects. And in particular cases like Iraq and perhaps Afghanistan in future, it will require American soldiers to run what are, in effect, American protectorates, just as, you know, NATO, and mostly now the Europeans, runs a couple of protectorates in the Balkans, Kosovo, even Macedonia. And while this may not be a classical empire, I think empire is probably the only, you know, sensible way to describe a plan like this. The question is, of course, whether faced with the reality and the reality of the costs of such an empire, the American people will really support this program. Because, as I say, it hasn't really been presented to them squarely just what they're getting themselves into.
The United States has certainly exerted considerable influence around the world for the last 50 years and overthrown governments it didn't like and mucked about in the domestic politics of all kinds of countries. How is this different from what's gone before?
What's different, I think, is that during the Cold War, fear of communism, of communist aggression and expansionism, meant that the U.S. could rely on a large number of very locally powerful and also sincerely committed allies, especially, of course, the Europeans, but many other countries around the world as well. Now, of course, that didn't mean they supported the U.S. in everything, you know, didn't support the U.S. in Vietnam, for example. But nonetheless, the U.S. could genuinely appear as the leader of well, the free world, because it was. And people accepted it as such, most people, you know, except for, obviously, some radicals and left-wingers and so forth. The problem is that that Soviet or communist threat has now obviously gone. There is no rival superpower against whom the US can rally other states. It's questionable whether terrorism can play the same role in creating genuine coalition behind the US, if only because if you take not just the Europeans but many other states, there is a very widespread, indeed I would say almost a universal perception in the rest of the world, that its aspects of America's own policy towards Israel in particular, which are helping to encourage terrorism. So while on the one hand, you know, countries obviously fear Islamic terrorism and want to cooperate with the US against it, there is also this doubt about wider US policies. And so the problem that I see is that this new American empire after the end of the Cold War may become even less consensual, if you like, than it was during the Cold War, and therefore that it will require even greater exertion of American military force on occasion. Trying to run existing American and Israeli policies against the united will of the Arab world could be a bloody business in the long run.
And that was Anatole Levin in an interview I recorded with him earlier today. Anatole Levin is a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace based in Washington. And apologies for all the male voices on this show. I'll try to bring in some female voices next week. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. Till next week, goodbye. And let's go off with these final words from Chicks on Speed.
Hey, I'm Alex. I'm a Taurus. I love tomatoes and black-capped chickadees.
Hi, I'm Jennifer. I really like biking in the park. And I like... Oh, I have all these friends.
Hi, my name is Pelle, and I'm a Pisces. I love computers and hot tamale.
Wanna be the captain of the Enterprise?
Wanna be the king of the Sulus?
Let's meet and have a baby.